It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why UW Oshkosh was selected as one of the most sustainable campuses in the nation.
First, we're focusing on the latest news out of Rowan County, Kentucky. Yesterday, County Clerk Kim Davis was jailed for refusing to provide marriage licenses to same-sex couples on the grounds of religious liberty.
And this morning, a deputy clerk for the county issued its first marriage license to a same-sex couple.
Kim Davis's trial and the issue of a marriage license today brought out supporters and protesters on both sides. Some presidential candidates even sounded off on the issue.
We're joined now by Kimmy King, WPR's legal correspondent, to discuss how these developments will affect the debate over religious liberty and marriage equality. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good. Well, let's dive into here. The arguments over religious liberty and same-sex marriage have been playing out over the last few months. We've talked about it a little bit with you. Where does this Kentucky case fit into all of that?
It goes where all of the issues associated with any of our hot-button topic issues go, and that is to the court of public opinion and to the courts, which ultimately have the last word. We're going to continue debating this, actually. Remember, after the decisions regarding interracial marriage back in 1967, it was almost 3 years in some parts of the United States where clerks were finally beginning to be challenged for issuing licenses. So, and then it was even into 1984 before interracial couples were, you could still be discriminated against as an interracial couple to adopt children. So the litigation is going to continue because once the court decided in Obergefell versus Hodges, which is the decision which found in favor of marriage equality, it has continued to further the debate that we as a country are having about how we should deal with this issue.
And this religious liberty issue has come up a lot. One difference here, a lot of what we've talked about in the past is a private business. Does it have the right or not to discriminate based on religious objections to same-sex marriage? This is a public employee we're talking about. Is that a different wrinkle and maybe something that will be approached in a different way in the courts of public opinion and of law?
Yes, it's very different in that sense from the Hobby Lobby case, which is the case that said that corporations can have religious beliefs, and that as a result of those religious beliefs, if they don't want to pay for contraception that they see as abortion, then they don't have to pay for that. This is very different. This is much more likened to the case of school districts not wanting to admit black children after Brown versus Board of Education. Clerks who didn't want to issue marriage certificates to interracial couples. If something is a law, as a government employee, you have to comply with the law. And that's part of the reason why the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, along with the U.S. Supreme Court, have denied overturning that judge's decision, which held her in contempt.
Now, in this particular case with Kim Davis, the clerk in Kentucky, she's in jail now, which neither side say they wanted. She didn't want to be there. The people who wanted to get their marriage licenses said, well, maybe a fine, but not jail. Is this a surprise to you that this contempt of court case ended up in jail here?
It's a little unusual, but remember that frequently in cases when you appear before a judge, if you don't answer questions, he or she can hold you in contempt right there. A contempt citation is really one of the biggest tools, the toughest tool that a judge has in order to get someone to comply. The reasoning behind what the judge did, even though the parties did not ask for this and they've indicated that they don't necessarily want this, is because he felt that a fine would not serve the purpose of having the law be complied with. And since she had stated that under no circumstances would she comply, he made the decision that we're just going to go ahead and jail you then, force this issue, because we have clerks across the country that are raising this issue. Ken Paxton, down here in Texas, our chief legal officer as attorney general, has encouraged clerks not to give same-sex marriage licenses. So far, we haven't had a showdown. I mean, part of why the showdown happened for Kim Davis is that the couple sued her and it forced the issue. What's happening right now quite frequently is that gay couples are going to, the only way to put this is to say gay-friendly county to get their certificates. And so clerks that are saying they're not going to issue them, couples are staying away from those counties because they just want to get married.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at this case, the clerk in Kentucky declined to grant any marriage certificates, actually citing religious objections to same-sex marriage, talking about where that's going to go. Is this going to be seen, Kimmy, as a test case by one or even both sides that they want to get into the court to clarify, to get some answers?
I think in part, but I'm not sure that this is the case that conservatives want to push. In part because it's a government employee who was elected by the people, that makes it complicated. So she can't even be fired by the Kentucky legislature, but she can be impeached. That makes it an additional complication. But this one is a little bit easier legally because imagine any government employee refusing for some moral grounds to carry out something that was supposed to be part of their job. This is, in essence, I will continue to say this, the clash of the constitutional titans. You have on the one hand religious liberty and people's moral convictions, which whenever government wants to interfere with them, they have to show a compelling government interest. That's a really good reason, which you might be able to do that because the other constitutional titan is the right to marry. There's a fundamental right to marry. And so what will happen then is that government may try to make the case that if you can carry out and protect the interest by using the least restrictive means, that's how I think this issue will be sidestepped. Because a court will find that you can have clerks who are not morally opposed to the law issuing the license. So I'm not sure that this is the test case. I think a better test case might be something like a baker who doesn't want to make a wedding cake for a GLBT couple for their wedding, simply because now you're more in line with the Hobby Lobby decision, which allows those religious beliefs to be held more closely. They're more dear.
I want to give a listen to Kim Davis's lawyer talking about the judge's decision to jail her, put her in jail for contempt.
Yeah. For the first time in history, an American citizen has been incarcerated for having the belief of conscience that marriage is the union of one man and one woman.
And that's one side of the argument, that she's jailed for her belief here. The other side, I guess, is jailed for refusing a judge's order and to do what the judge says is part of her job. But do you see that argument being pursued going forward, that this is someone who's being punished over her decision based on conscience?
Oh, absolutely. And there are multiple grounds on which she can make this claim. Some are better than others, not only the First Amendment, but the, you know, arguably, some people are trying to argue the Religious Freedom Restoration Act also provides additional rights to her as a result. To be quite honest with you, this is going to be one of those cases that until it's, you know, worked through the courts when she appears in, you know, and depending on what happens with the contempt and how long they hold her. Remember, one of the things about a contempt of court citation is it's not something that you can just be bailed out for. And so depending on where this case goes, we're going to have a court weigh in on the issue. And then when that court weighs in on it, that decision will be appealed and we will start getting a standard that can evolve for how it relates to at least government-elected employees. Then you may have appointed government employees. Then you may have private business cases that come along. But we are going to continue to have a different kind of patchwork litigation that occurs related to this issue.
And you mentioned that Kim Davis's lawyers had applied to federal courts, to the Supreme Court, asking for relief, I think was the technical word. They said no, at least not for right now. Is this something that federal courts are going to want to touch?
No. And state courts don't want to touch it either. And they don't have the authority to be able to touch it. Politicians are weighing in, but they're using it largely for their own symbolic purposes, right? And so that's why it's playing out in the court of public opinion. That's why you're having the protesters and the supporters of Kim Davis, you know, outside the courtroom, and you're going to continue to see this momentum build, because this is something that our society is going through. Sometimes I think we have this fear of great constitutional debates like this, when the reality is our democracy is strong enough to handle this. We're just going to have to let it play itself out.
Kimmy, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
You betcha. Take care.
That's Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, talking about the latest in the Kentucky marriage license saga.
The Sierra Club recently ranked college campuses across the nation on their sustainability efforts and green initiatives.
The Sierra Club invited four-year campuses to enter the competition. The group looked at several areas ranging from on-campus gardening projects to renewable energy and alternative transportation options, as well as their course offerings.
Coming in at number three in the Sierra Club rankings is the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh.
Joining us now to talk about their efforts there is Brian Kermath. He's the Sustainability Director for UW Oshkosh. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here.
So you applied for this. A surprise to get to such a high honor. 150 or 180-some schools applied, and UW-Oshkosh, number three in the nation.
Well, sure, it was a bit of a surprise in some ways, but we worked hard at rising through the ranks over the years, and I'm not entirely surprised that we made it that far.
We'll get into some of the specifics, but generally, how did sustainability become a priority there?
Well, it goes back to about the year 2000, when a number of students on campus requested that the university undergo some environmental audits. And those audits led to some discoveries where we could save energy, a significant amount of energy, which would also result in money savings as well. And after those audits were completed, the university decided, hey, this is an area where, you know, we can really make some progress and make a name for ourselves
and
do the right thing.
As I read those Sierra Club rankings, that's one of the categories where UW-Oshkosh did really well, was energy conservation. Can you talk about some of the things you've done, some of the practical steps you've taken there to try to save energy?
Yeah, exactly. And going back again to early 2001, somewhere in there, one of the things that we could really make progress on quickly was to upgrade lighting, and so lighting was a main target. Later on, we brought in Johnson Controls, which is a Wisconsin-based Fortune 500 company, to help us make progress with other kinds of energy efficiency equipment, pumps, air handlers, HVAC systems, and things like that. So we did an awful lot of that. We're now saving approximately $300,000 a year through those initiatives, and lots of energy, and it also results in a reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions. We've also embarked on renewable energy installations on campus. We have, I think it's the largest concentration of solar thermal panels in the state on a state facility. We have about 300 panels. We have about 220 panels, photovoltaic panels, which generate electricity. And we now have three biodigesters that generate electricity, convert waste, organic waste, into methane gas. We burn the gas and generate electricity.
And you mentioned, Brian, saving, I think, $300,000 a year from those energy conservation efforts. Were there a lot of upfront costs? Was it a hurdle to overcome to get to that point where you could save that much annually?
Well, that's a good question. So initially we saw the opportunities and we said, wow, it's going to cost a lot of money. Fortunately, what's happened over the last several decades is that companies such as Johnson Controls have seen opportunities to come in and help institutions like universities to make those kinds of investments when the institution itself doesn't have the money for the upfront cost. So Johnson Controls, for example, puts the money up to make the upgrades, and then the university repays the debt through savings. Once the debt is paid, then the university realizes the full amount of the savings. So it's really a fabulous mechanism. They're usually referred to as power purchase agreements or performance contracts, and we've taken advantage of a number of them. We're actually entering into phase four with Johnson Controls on performance contracts.
So that's energy savings. Water savings also were ranked highly by the Sierra Club. What have you done to conserve water on your campus?
We replaced over 2,000 plumbing fixtures, toilets, and sink fixtures and shower heads. And we basically cut in half our consumption of potable water. And as a result, that saves us about $135,000 a year in water costs and heating costs to heat water for the hot water.
We're talking to Brian Kermath. He's the sustainability director for UW Oshkosh. The campus was recognized number 3 in the nation for environmental sustainability efforts. Let's get to course offerings. That was part of what they were looking at. Of course, they're looking at universities here and whether sustainability classes are offered. They noted that students there at UW Oshkosh volunteered in an urban agriculture program, a growing Oshkosh, as part of one of the classes. How did that come about?
Well, okay, so, you know, over the years, faculty usually teach classes that are relevant to things that are happening in society, and so there have always been a number of, you know, really good courses on this campus related to sustainability, and there continues to be. But a couple of years ago, the university embarked on a revised general education program, and that program is called the University Studies Program. And it has three what we call signature questions that all students must take. One of those signature questions deals with sustainability, and some of those courses require the students to become involved in community projects. And the one that you just referenced was actually through a sustainability course in the general education program offered by a business professor who had partnered with a local organization called Growing Oshkosh. And Growing Oshkosh is involved in community garden development. They're planting gardens on local schools. And downtown they have a small farm, essentially an urban farm, where they're producing fresh organic produce. And so our students got to help out with that project. It was a great learning experience.
In general, have students on the campus been pretty involved in these sustainability efforts?
Well, yeah, as I said, I think the impetus for much of this around 2000 came from students, and the students have been an integral part of keeping things going, I think, on this campus. UW Oshkosh is really pretty unique, if I might just take a second here. Oftentimes what you find on campuses is that there is, a critical mass of students that's driving it, or a group of faculty, or perhaps staff members, or maybe it's being led by the administration. At Oshkosh, we have a really good network across campus. That critical mass includes people from all constituencies on campus. And so, yes, students are involved, but they work very cooperatively with faculty, staff, and the administration.
Looking ahead, Brian, what are some of the next steps for sustainability at UW Oshkosh?
Well, one of our commitments that we signed on to in 2007 is called the American College and University President's Climate Commitment. I know that's a mouthful, but and that commitment pledges us to become what is known as climate neutral within the next 10 to 15 years. And climate neutral means that we need to reduce our emissions of fossil carbon to zero by the commitment date, and we're making good progress on it, but we still have a lot to do, and so that's going to be a big part of our focus is doing more with renewable energy, doing more with buying green energy credits, which is essentially a premium on your electricity purchase that goes into an investment pool to build wind turbines, for example, in the state. So that's going to be a big part of it. But we also need to continue to build our academic side. That includes this new university studies program, more course offerings. Perhaps we'll see a sustainability major of some kind in the not-too-distant future. And more research. We're going to work hard to provide incentives for faculty to get involved in more sustainability-related research. We already have a lot, but there's a lot more to do, and I think we can make tremendous headway in that area as well.
And do you have other campuses or even other institutions coming to you saying, hey, how are you doing this? What can we learn from you?
Well, sure. We participate in a number of organizations related to sustainability on campuses, and we give regular presentations at those conferences. One of my bosses, the Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services, recently gave a webinar to his peers across the country on how we do it, how we've been able to do it. And let me just stress there, one of the important points in doing it is to partner with the right kinds of organizations and companies in particular.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Brian Kermath. He's the Sustainability Director for UW Oshkosh. Their campus was recently recognized by the Sierra Club as one of the most environmentally sustainable in the nation. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Labor Day weekend. Professional and college football games are starting soon, too, and all that means that potluck season is in full swing.
Our next guest brings us some new twists on classic potluck offerings on this week's edition of Food Friday.
Emily Tyra joins us now. She's senior editor at Taste of Home magazine. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Emily, in your opinion, what makes the ideal potluck dish?
Potluck dishes should be something that has flavors everyone loves. They should serve 12 or more, and most of all, they should just be the person who's bringing the dish's favorite specialty dish. That's kind of the cool thing about potlucks, that when you only have one dish to bring, you can bring your absolute favorite thing.
So you don't have to cover all the bases yourself. You can just put all your effort into that one special thing.
Exactly, and I like a potluck to not be an overly controlled atmosphere. If you're hosting, you can give people general categories, bring a salad, bring a condiment, but bring dessert, but don't overly boss that situation so that they can have fun.
Well, and Emily, we were just talking about this before the show with that word salad. So how specific do we want it? Because salad could be like all green stuff. Or it could be all green stuff. Green stuff is jello. You know, jello.
Salad could
mean a lot of stuff.
Mainly marshmallows. Exactly. Well, at Taste of Home, we have all of the above. We definitely have our fair share of wonderful Midwestern potluck salads that would have jello as their base. We also have pasta salads galore. We know our readers love pasta and potato salads this time of year.
Well, and your latest issue looks at potluck dishes that you can make ahead of time, which is nice if you're doing things on the go. Why is that ability to do it ahead of time so important to a potluck dish?
Well, we love taking the stress out of things for people. So if everything is planned and done the day before, the morning of your potluck, whether you're hosting it or bringing a dish, then you can just come and relax. I think most of our dishes have gone through our test kitchen. Actually, all of them go through our test kitchen, and we knew this would be for a potluck story, so we made sure, for example, that our sausage bread sandwich recipe would be something that you could pull from the freezer or bake off that morning and then throw it on the grill, and it'll work either way.
And we'll get into some of the specific recipes you shared with us today, but before we get there, what are some of the staples? What are the ones that we see every time at the potluck, or that we want to see every time at the potluck?
Well, I'm a deviled egg person myself, so I always try to eyeball those first and grab one. We also know people love to have baked beans and things maybe that are in a slow cooker simmering away. In Wisconsin, we're really not shy about our potlucking, so we'll make sure there's extension cords and whatever means possible to plug in a slow cooker for your mac and cheese or your baked beans.
We're talking to Emily Tyra right now. She's the senior editor of Taste of Home magazine. And you mentioned those deviled eggs, Emily. Now, you've got a recipe that you sent to us where you take that traditional recipe that everybody likes to see on the table and you give it a twist. What have you done with it?
Well, we've been seeing a lot of submissions of buffalo chicken everything at Taste of Home. People are sending in buffalo chicken lasagnas, buffalo chicken dips, and we've done a buffalo chicken deviled egg recipe from Robin Spires from Tampa, Florida. And basically, it's all the flavors of buffalo chicken wings in a deviled egg, including the blue cheese crumbles sprinkled on top.
Does it taste like a buffalo chicken wing?
Absolutely, but also like a deviled egg, so you're getting everything you love.
And we've got this one up at the Central Time Facebook page. Can you talk us through, though, how we make this, how we integrate the chicken into the egg? And which comes first?
Good. Exactly. Well, you're going to want finely chopped cooked chicken, so that the finer you chop it or shred it, then the better it will integrate into that yolk mixture. And then it's your typical mayonnaise-based yolk mixture, but instead of adding pickle juice or vinegar or something like that to give your tang, you're adding the buffalo wing sauce, which has that same zip and tang to it.
And how do people like this one if they like buffalo chicken? Is this going to be a crowd pleaser at like a football game and a potluck?
Absolutely. They're going to love it. And also, I must tell you that at Taste of Home, the deviled egg capital, we have over 150 deviled egg recipes at tasteofhome.com. Wow. So if buffalo chicken isn't your thing, then you will find the deviled egg of your dreams, I promise.
We've got a big buffalo chicken fan here, our producer, Chris Molina. We've got the recipe on the Central Time Facebook. Should we make this one and see how many Chris can eat in one sitting?
I don't know if we want to find out the answer to that question.
I know. In my family, you get there first. That's why I was saying you eyeball the table first, because people in my family eat deviled eggs like it's popcorn, just tossing them in their mouths. So.
Huh. I find a little goes a long way, but okay. I respect that. Well, let's get to another one of the recipes. You sent us a recipe in the current issue of Taste of Home, honey cinnamon bars, so a dessert for our potluck. Have you tried this one out yourself?
Yes. Yes, I tried it in the test kitchen. It's wonderful. It's subtly spiced with cinnamon, and the honey is a really lovely addition to it, and there's walnuts right in the actual bar, and then you have the option of sprinkling some on top. We find we like to do half and half for potlucks to just keep that crowd-pleasing element there for you.
So is this one going to use the stuff you have in your pantry, or is there anything fancy that goes into this one?
No, these are really basic pantry staple recipes that we have at Taste of Home, and this definitely fits in that category. You make it in a jelly roll pan, so you get kind of a shallow fill on the bar, and then you put this wonderful glaze over it, which does have a secret ingredient, which is mayonnaise.
Ooh, what is
I know, hear me out.
We are skeptical.
Okay, I'll tell you what. It's really a nice way to make a glaze rich and smooth. Really, mayonnaise is just oil and eggs, so it makes sense that whisked in with a bunch of confectioner's sugar and vanilla and some extra nuts, it's really just a smooth, beautiful glaze that will coat the top of this honey cinnamon bar.
And is mayonnaise one of the staples of the potluck? Do you want to try to use as much of it as possible?
In my world, yes. In a lot of our readers' world, definitely. I think it's nice, though, to have a balance. So maybe when you invite your guests, you could say, hey, you bring a mayonnaise-based salad, you bring something a little more green and crunchy, and in that way you're not having all mayo-based. However, sometimes that's the way it works out. Sometimes it's all dessert, and you can just eat cake then.
Do you have to plan ahead, hey, this is going to be a finger food kind of setting. We're going to be sitting in front of the football game. We don't want a lot of forks and messy stuff versus, you know, we're going to sit down and eat at the potluck so you can bring a soup and some bowls or you know, more serving intensive types of food?
Absolutely. I think most people prefer to be able to mingle and stand. So I think that's what makes an ideal potluck dish, that you're able to stand comfortably and eat it, or just balance and sit on a chair. If you did bring a soup or something like a chili or macaroni and cheese, we like to have, you know, just a mug or a cup so that people can still hang on to it and walk around and chat.
We're talking to Emily Tyra from Taste of Home magazine. She is sharing some great potluck recipes with us today.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite potluck dish, one that you always bring and everybody goes nuts for? Do you like to put your own spin on something more traditional, kind of like these buffalo chicken deviled eggs that we've been talking about? Let us know. What about what you do with your favorite dips or pasta salads? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our discussion about favorite potluck recipes right now, and you can join the conversation.
Do you have that go-to recipe you bring to the potlucks? Everyone is going to be disappointed if you don't bring that thing. Have you put your own twist on a classic potluck dish? Is there something that somebody else makes that you're always looking forward to? You want to share that with us? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave us a comment and check out a recipe or two on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Andrew on the line in Waupaca. Hi, Andrew.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
So my favorite potluck dish?
Uh-huh.
First I told you guys it was scalloped potatoes, but I don't know exactly what my mom puts in that, but I like brats. I put brats in the slow cooker and hamburgers loaded up with beer, throw in onions, mushrooms, just let it sit for a while, go back to it, and then eat it up.
All right, what do you call that?
Brats and burgers.
Okay. Very literal translation there, brats, burgers, mushrooms, and beer. I don't know, what do you do? Do you serve it on a bun?
Just pretty much eat it however you want it. You can put brats with the scalloped potatoes if someone else brought them, hamburger, however you want to do it. It's all about the mushrooms and the onions, though.
Okay.
Because anyone can make the burgers and brats, but the mushrooms and the onions, they just make everything.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that, Andrew. And Andrew's definitely hitting on a couple Wisconsin favorites there, combining the brats and the hamburger. The surprise is the slow cooker and the onions and the mushrooms. What do you think about that one, Emily?
I love it. I actually know that we call it a brat fry, but everyone has their own way of doing it. Brat fry usually means sizzling on the grill, or how amazing to put it in a slow cooker with beer so people can come get a hot brat any time throughout the day or night.
Andrew, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Emily Tyra from Taste of Home magazine. Yeah, I'm a big fan of when slow cookers at potlucks, when other people bring stuff that I usually wouldn't make for myself. So Sloppy Joe's, big fan of. You remember Bob, who used to work in our shop here, used to bring meatballs in the slow cooker a lot.
Yeah.
Again, things I don't do slow cooked meatballs. So that's not even on my radar to make slow cooker stuff and then bring it to a potluck, Emily. You want to make the case for that?
Isn't it amazing what we can do, though? You can put the lid on the slow cooker and tape it down. I like to make sure people really think it through ahead, though. When you're traveling with a slow cooker on your lap, you want to have it in a box or something to prevent it from spilling everywhere. I'm sure your listeners have lots of stories about trying to take meatballs across town or brats in a slow cooker. I think it's nice if the hostess does that main dish kind of thing. If the hostess is in charge of the brats, then you can say, hey, this is a BYOC party where everyone brings their own favorite condiment, like a mushroom and onion mixture or a great slaw.
Now, you've got another recipe that you shared with us. This one's called pasta salad in a jar. Tell us about this one.
Well, this is a classic antipasto type salad put in a jar with kind of a wide mouth to it so that you can take it to a potluck and use the jar itself as your bowl. And the flavors are really just classic Greek and Mediterranean flavors with lots of fresh basil. I know people probably have the last hurrah on their garden of basil growing in their pots or in their garden, and this would be a great recipe to use that in.
So why the jar?
Well, it's just a fun way to present, really, at a picnic or potluck. It's kind of a nostalgic look, but also it's easy to tuck that in a cooler, and you don't need to worry about transferring it to a different serving dish when you get there.
We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234, looking for your favorite potluck dish, the one that you make that's a big hit at the party. 800-642-1234 is the number. We've got Jill on the line in Toma. Jill, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I have a favorite recipe that's can be hot, cold, or room temperature, and it can be, you know, Christmas or outside picnic. It's a brown rice. It's kind of like the Uncle Ben's brown rice. You just make it like you'd be baking that rice dish with original recipe spices in it. And so you just put that in your 9.5 by 11 glass dish, drizzle Italian dressing over it, and then you top the whole thing with tomatoes, bite-sized tomatoes, cashews, chopped onions, and avocado, and black olives.
Wow, so it's kind of like a seven-layer salad, but not beans. It's got rice in it instead. That sort
of deal. Yeah, yeah. It's just the body of it is rice. And it's kind of Christmassy because you have that green and the red from the tomatoes and avocado.
Love it. And, of course,
you put cashews on anything, and it's really great.
Great. Jill, thank you so much for sharing that. And I guess if you wanted to fancy that up, Emily, you could maybe she was just saying go with, hey, your wheat rice or brown rice from a box. You could mix in some wild rice, too, to jazz it up a little, Emily.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. And I love what you said about it's great at room temp or cold. I think that's a hallmark of a great potluck dish, that it even tastes better after it sits at room temp.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Jill. Appreciate it. And we're going to go to Ninja in La Crosse. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, what is your vote for potluck?
My dish is a little bit different because it's not one of those ones you can just stand and talk around. You actually have to sit down and eat it. It's a stew. It's a Russian-Ukrainian stew called Solyanka.
And
a friend taught me how to make it. It's mostly meat-based and tomato-based. So I use 3 cans of meat, chicken, beef sausage, and Polish kielbasa with I guess you would consider it like almost like a 2-liter can of tomato sauce or tomato soup. And I put it in a big pot, put in a couple of vegetables, onions, carrots. Sometimes I add mushrooms or garlic. And then I put in chopped pickles, dill pickles, which sounds weird, but it turns out great. And black olives, whole black olives. And then when you serve it, you put a dollop of fresh sour cream and a slice of lemon. And the sour cream makes it super creamy, and the lemon just gives it a little extra tangy kick.
Wow, well, that's interesting. Thank you so much for that. That one sounds like it's got a lot of strong, wonderful flavors to it. So, Emily, have you heard of that kind of stew before?
No, it sounds fantastic, though, and it would be so fun for a tailgate.
I was going to say it sounds a little like chili until she got to things like pickles and lemon and sour cream, and that gives it that Eastern European flair that she was moving toward.
Absolutely. I know, and I love that pickle juice can be a secret ingredient in a lot of people's favorite dishes.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Emily Tyra, senior editor for Taste of Home magazine, with some favorite potluck recipes, and we're taking yours at 800-642-1234. Lucille is with us next in Bayfield. Lucille, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Lucille?
Well, I have a recipe that always makes a great hit whenever I take it. I call it Rosy Sauerkraut. And I just get sauerkraut and rinse it off to get some of the sour off. And then I cook it with cranberry sauce and cook it so that it heats up very well and stir it up. And it's a wonderful color. And you can eat it with anything as a condiment, or some people just like it to eat by itself.
Lucille, I want that on a burger now. That sounds perfect.
It might be good on a burger.
That sounds wonderful. We have a similar recipe in the issue of Taste of Home that's out right now, September, October, from a cranberry farmer in Toma, and she does a similar mixture of sauerkraut and cranberries to dress a meatball in the slow cooker. So I think that burger plus cranberry plus sauerkraut could be the magic combo there.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about that one, Lucille. And we're going to go next to Shelley in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi there, Shelley.
Hi. I was just calling to give you a family recipe for potluck that we all love, and it's just it's called chicken gumbo burgers, just made with ground beef and chicken gumbo soup, about one can to a pound and a half of ground beef, and a little bit of crazy salt in there.
Crazy salt, what's that?
Well, it's called Jane's Crazy Mixed Up Salt, yeah. And the soup is just your traditional chicken gumbo soup.
Okay, so you buy the chicken gumbo soup ready to go?
Yep, buy it ready to go. The ones you would add water to, I guess.
Nice.
But it's just one can to a pound and a half of browned ground beef, and then you season it with that crazy salt.
Nice. Well, that's really kicking that into gear and giving it a twist. Appreciate that suggestion, Shelley.
And Emily, before we let you go, do you have one last quick idea to share with us for that next potluck we're going to head to?
Well, sure. I think this weekend is still pretty hot here in Wisconsin, so I have a great tip for you guys where you would buy a kiddie pool and get a brand new kiddie pool that you can then delegate to be your potluck kiddie pool from here on out. You bring that to the potluck, put it on a corner of a picnic table. Maybe you put two together to create an L shape and then balance the kiddie pool there. Everyone puts their ice in that, and that's where you can nest all of your pasta salads, potato salads, mayo things that need to stay cold.
That's great.
And they can just hang out in the pool.
Great presentation. Emily, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Happy Labor Day.
That's Emily Tyra, senior editor at Taste of Home magazine. We've got some of these potluck recipes we've talked about on the Central Time Facebook page. A very special Wisconsin event kicks off today in Prairie du Sac. It is the 41st annual cow chip throw.
And yep, it is exactly what it sounds like. Contestants compete to throw a cow chip, that kind of cow chip, as far as they can. These are dried, and the website points out that these chips are nice and odorless.
Yeah, so this was part of my welcome to Wisconsin. I moved here in 1991, didn't know anybody, went for a drive to Natural Bridge State Park, mm-hmm. coming back. I see a sign for the cow chip throw. I'm like, okay, got to stop at that. And so, yeah, people are lining up. There's a big trailer full of dried cow chips.
And you, not from Wisconsin, knew what a cow chip was when you signed
well,
on
I
for
mean,
this.
I'm from Michigan. There are cows there, too.
Right, but not as many.
It's not as cow intensive.
Right.
It's true. And so, yeah, people, and you could tell the pros from the, like, ha-ha tourists who came by. You know, the tourists, one of them, like, lobbed one into the bleachers. But I in 1990... Sorry.
I have not done this. Are these frisbee shaped?
Yeah, they're kind of wide and flat. But the key is, if you throw like a frisbee, you're an amateur. Overhand is the winning thing. And I saw the state record still stands to this day, 248 feet. The state record.
Impressive. Throw,
and I was there.
Impressive. I can tell that you're still moved by this years later.
I was part of history.
You were.
Would you do? I didn't do it. I got there too late to sign up. Would you do it?
No.
I wouldn't do it, not because of the cow chip, because I'd look like an amateur.
Well, I'd to watch someone else doing it.
Yeah, it was fun. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.